Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow-up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.
Hello, and welcome to the Ghibliotech, the podcast that rows through the river of films from the world's greatest animation studio, Studio Ghibli. I'm Michael Leader, and I've seen the lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm on the outside looking in.
So join us on our quest into the glorious world of Ghibli. Here we are once again, Jake, talking about Studio Ghibli and the Ghibliotech.
Yeah, you came in with quite a somber welcome there, which is perhaps appropriate for this film.
Yes, this week we're talking about When Marnie Was There, the second feature directed for Ghibli by Hiromasa Yonobayashi, and possibly the most emo film in the Ghibli canon, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you've got those kind of like scene emo characters like Howl. But I think this is maybe the most textured emo that we've had so far.
It's also, we must say, the most recent Ghibli film released. It was, at the time, many people thought, the final Studio Ghibli film that they would produce and release.
Yes, we have our chronology that we do in our own strange way. And so it is naturally that we've got to the second episode of our third series where we will do the final film.
And we still have another 10 to go or whatever, exactly.
But we've got our reasons, and there's a reason that we're watching When Marnie Was There.
Exactly. Bear with us. Put your faith in us. We'll take your hand and lead you through the Ghibliotech. Of course, we'll be discussing a synopsis, the production history, and your first take review. There will be spoilers, and this is a film, I would say, that can be spoiled. There are twists and turns in this film that if you want to watch it fresh, I'd recommend you go away and watch the film first. The podcast will be here when you come back, because otherwise we'll be blowing this one wide open.
Yeah.
So should we crack on, Jake?
Yeah, this is When Marnie Was There.
A shy teenager called Anna has an anxiety attack at school and spends a summer in the marshy wetlands of rural Hokkaido to recuperate, staying with relatives of her foster mother. There, in an abandoned mansion that sits perched on the edge of a lake, she finds a blonde-haired girl called Marnie, and the two develop an intimate friendship that transcends time and, over the long summer days, helps to bring Anna out of her shell. But who is this beautiful, mysterious girl from the past, and just what is her relationship to Anna?
Okay, Michael, we will perhaps delve a bit further into it in our review section, but there's a lot going on this film, and it is really interesting that currently, as you say, this is the last Studio Ghibli film, and I'm craving some knowledge as to how we ended up with it.
Well, let's pick up with Hiromasa Yonobayashi where we left him last, which is when Arrietty was made and released. It was a hit. We talked about it very much as a Miyazaki cover version, but it did very well at the box office.
It was huge in America as well.
I think it's to date still the highest grossing Ghibli film at the American box office. Miyazaki liked it as well. We talk about Miyazaki hazing Hiromasa Yonobayashi a lot in the making of Arrietty, but he then said when he saw the final film, it was good, I cried. So if you can make Miyazaki cry, I think you can do anything. But then, as soon as Arrietty comes out, the studio gets stuck into this double bill, The Wind Rises and The Tale of the Princess Kaguya. Hayao Miyazaki and Isao Takahata making two massive films that at the time would stand as their final statements.
Yeah, and those feel like it's the end of the road for those two directors who we think of as a reflection of the studio. Exactly. So it's just so weird that you have these bookends and then this strange little post-it note stuck on the end of the shelf.
Exactly. So while those films are being made, Hiromasa Yonobayashi goes up to Toshio Suzuki and says, I really want to direct another feature. Is there anything I can do? And Suzuki gives him this novel, When Marnie Was There, by Joan G. Robinson, which is a sort of mid-20th century English kids book that was not, it did not become part of the young adult canon over here.
It wasn't in print.
It wasn't even in print when the film came out, exactly, but it's one of those strange Western European stories that is popular in Japan. But it's another example of Toshio Suzuki almost being the Alex Ferguson of Studio Ghibli, being like, I'll pair you up with just the right situation here to create something magical. Suzuki says that there are a couple of reasons why he thought that Hiromasa Yonobayashi was perfect for the project. One being that the film was about two young girls. And he says, just as Miyazaki enjoyed drawing fighter planes as a kid, Hiromasa Yonobayashi probably had a steadfast liking for drawing girls. I think that sounds a bit creepy, maybe out of context. But he also says that Miyazaki couldn't make a film like Marnie. Yonobayashi was clearly more of a sensitive soul than Miyazaki, and he was younger. Suzuki says, I instinctively felt that this film would have an appeal that differed from Miyazaki's fantasy films. So he hands over the reins of producer. So Suzuki is very busy at this time and getting on a bit. So he hands over the reins of producer to this younger chap called Yoshiaki Nishimura, who had produced The Tale of Princess Kaguya. So this is a new generation.
So we haven't got any of the key three.
It's the first film in the Ghibli canon that has, yeah, exactly, none of the three key creative partners. Suzuki is involved in a general manager type credit, but it's the first film without Miyazaki and Takahata involved at all. Yonobayashi at the time said he has to make this film without the help from the giant. Really exciting, really, and yeah, unique in the canon. And then Yonobayashi has a few ideas. Not only is this a brand new beginning, a brand new start behind the camera, but he wants this to look different. These visual ideas he brings to the table, he wanted more detail in the characters' expressions, particularly their eyes, building on from Marietti, because this is such an emotional film that expressions were key and held such importance in the narrative. But also, he wanted this to be set in a different, completely new area. They went and did scouting trips up in Hokkaido in northern Japan, specifically these marshy wetland areas, locations that hadn't been represented on screen by Ghibli before. And he wanted to get away from, and this is something I know you love in previous films, the trademark green rolling hills, blue skies, these bright primary colors that are so associated with Ghibli. He wanted overlapping hues, occluded skylines that could represent the tumultuous emotional textures of the film, and he wanted to, what he described, to capture a pearl-coloured sky.
Yeah, I mean, I love those colours, and so going into this, knowing that this man was going to mess up my lovely blue skies, I obviously had some concerns.
This could be the first occasion of nerd rage, yeah, for you on the podcast, yes, maybe. This is not my Ghibli, they've ruined my childhood.
Yes, yes, release the Miyazaki cut.
Exactly. Marnie is released in July 2014, just 8 months after The Tale of Princess Kaguya, which was delayed from its summer release the year previous. And it only grosses just over a third of what Arrietty took in 2010. So it's seen as something of a disappointment. And actually, at the end of the year, it only just cracks the top 10 of the highest grossing Japanese films of the year. So really, we talk about this every week, don't we? Every episode. The Ghibli films are up there domestically for Japanese language films. This one is actually underperforming. And internationally, it's pretty well reviewed, well received, gets that rollout that most of the Ghibli films do at this point. It's nominated for an Oscar in 2015, but it loses to Inside Out. And there's generally this feeling in many of the reviews that it's this sputtering of the engines, to use a fighter plane metaphor.
It feels like it suffers from, you're coming from this mad double bill. Like these huge closing statements.
We'll get to them. They're both over 2 hours long. They're both doing something that neither of the filmmakers had done before. This is The Wind Rises and Princess Kaguya. And they both feel like mic drop moments. So a bit weird that the sort of nerdy guy in the corner, Yonobayashi, comes and picks up that microphone and goes, can I tell my weird little story about two girls now, please? So it really feels like, what is this film? It doesn't, is not helped by the fact that...
So is this like Ringo doing Yellow Submarine?
Best Beatles song? Don't you put Ringo down. This is for our Beatle Attack spin-off podcast, of course. But it's not helped at all that I think less than a month after Marnie's released in Japan, Toshio Suzuki makes a statement saying that Ghibli's going to go on an indefinite hiatus. He calls it a little pause, but everyone's like, oh, yeah, sure, that's the end of Studio Ghibli then. While Marnie is still in cinemas, almost like cutting it off at the legs before it's even had a chance to develop its own speed. And as we said, this is the final fully produced Ghibli film to date. But that doesn't stop Yonobayashi. Don't worry about him. About a year after this film is released, it's announced that Yoshiaki Nishimura, that young producer I mentioned, was going to form his own studio called Studio Ponoc. And he poached Yonobayashi and a bunch of Ghibli animators that suddenly found themselves out of work to go and make films in the Ghibli vein, keeping that legacy going. And they very quickly turned around this film, Mary and the Witch's Flower, which is not a Ghibli film, but has so much Ghibli DNA in it that maybe one day we'll have to cover it.
I'm sure that'll end up in our episode library one day.
But let's stick with When Marnie Was There. This is a controversial, strange, unique film in the Ghibli canon. I can't wait to hear what you made of it, Jake. Jake, we've teed this up as being so different to every film we've covered so far, almost, even from the very beginning, right?
Yeah, we often talk about these opening scenes, how they set us up for the film we're about to watch. And this begins with really an anxiety attack, which is a huge surprise. And it becomes, we've already spoken about the pressure that was on Yonobayashi, about how he has to view himself underneath the giants of the directors before him. And this anxiety attack that Anna experiences comes after she presents artwork to someone and that artwork is dismissed.
Mm-hmm. It's almost a little bit more complicated than that, though. It's not dismissed. It's so she's in the playground and the teacher comes over and says, what are you doing? What are you drawing in the corner there? And she goes to show him, but he's called away by something else in the playground. And it's just that sense of opening herself up to the vulnerability of exposing her art to somebody else and then that not being met by interest. That is such already, in the first scene of the film, such a complicated emotional sequence to play, character moment. And we're already off the reservation here, aren't we?
Yeah. And she's a really interesting character. You feel for her straight away because it's a film that doesn't deal in binaries of good and evil. Even though Miyazaki doesn't really have antagonists, it's very often quite clear who is good and who is bad.
Mm-hmm.
And here we've got in the opening, we have the clique of girls who go and check up on Anna. And they're not like a mean girls fraternity type club. They actually sincerely want to go and talk to her and help her. And they're not really presented as being friends. They're just concerned classmates. And Anna doesn't really want that. She doesn't quite know how to process that engagement. She's really unsure of how to deal with herself in society. She feels so disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And compare Anna to Kiki, who we spoke about in our previous episode. At the start of that adventure, everything clicks into place. I'm 13, I'm a witch, I got to go and do my thing. And she's off and she's out the door. In comparison, the reason that Anna leaves the city, out to the country, something that we've seen before in other Ghibli films, is not because of this sense of direction. It's a sense of confusion.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, I interviewed Yonobayashi when this film played at the London Film Festival a few years ago, and I asked him about that protagonist. And he compared her to Arietti. He said, Arietti is an adventurous young girl who wants to go out and engage with these giants of human beings that are living in the same house as her. Whereas Marnie, he wanted to explore a character who was locked off, closed off, and shy and anxious. Almost an undramatic character, you know, protagonist to have.
Mm.
And it's over the course of this film, seeing her open up as she goes to Hokkaido. You see familiar landscapes. We love a good train journey in a Ghibli film.
Yep.
We have that here. But then you see these landscapes of Hokkaido, the marshlands, the occluded skies. What was that like for you, Jake?
Well, it's really interesting because you're in this uncanny territory of being able to recognize images but also they're unfamiliar at the same time. because, as you say, we've seen these trains, we've seen rolling hills, we've seen skies, we've seen food that in this film as well, that feels like there is that Ghibli DNA, but it has been distorted in quite an interesting way. I really love, this might come as a surprise to you, I love these overcast skies. I think they set in the background of so much of the film this murk, this fog that resides within Anna. Mm-hmm. And it really sets you up of giving this emotional texture to the entire world around her, rather than just being a place to for animators to build wild creatures and beautiful landscapes and express what they want and put those behind the characters. It's this constant interlinking between the shape of the world and Anna's mind.
And it's an ambition with a goal, isn't it? Yonabashi also talked about wanting that alluring magical mansion on the lakeside to be look like a magical place. It's almost designed in a photorealistic way. Mm. At the time, in the Ghibli Museum, they had an exhibition of the actual scale model they made of that building, almost to architectural standards, so they could light it from all these different angles, so they could then represent that as ultra photorealistically as possible on screen.
It's an infinitely screenshottable film.
Well, in fact, I actually have one of those landscapes as my laptop screen at home when I can see it behind all those icons that I let clutter up my screen.
All those other Ghibli screenshots. and he refers to them as pearl skies. Mm-hmm. And you do get that. As much as I love that blank blue, which is wonderful, the way that these skies just kind of drift into the background, constantly changing between these, like there are these blue and purple dusks that are absolutely stunning.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the occluded skies and how that represents the torment and tumult in the heart of our character and the changes she's going through, the things she's wrestling with. Often in these discussions, we like to dance on top of the film and talk about our highlights and things that strike us. We can't do that with this film.
Yeah, I mean, I think perhaps that's the end of our stylistic review. We got to delve into this story, I think, because it turns into something quite spectacular in the last 10 minutes.
We talk about ambition, and this film on a story, thematic, character level is also so ambitious. Ghibli films, Miyazaki films in particular, have these clean character arcs, clean character lines of the struggle of identity, place in the world, good hard labor, finding your passion, committing to it. Maybe it's a daily struggle, but at least you have that path. This film throws into the pot so many hot button topics that
yes.
I think let's just at least go through the roll call to begin with. So it's there in the trailer that this film suggests that Marnie and Anna may have a romantic relationship, or at least the suggestion of that.
I mean, and there is perhaps some lines of dialogue that may suggest that as well, such as, "You're my precious secret, the girl from my dreams."
I've never loved another girl more than you, or whatever the other one was.
Yeah.
That, first of all, is groundbreaking for Ghibli. We have, as we said, anxiety attacks, mental health issues. Miyazaki and Kiki's Delivery Service, and other films, talks about when you feel down or blue, but we don't have them having an actual panic attack. We have foster families. Anna has her foster family. She falls out with her foster mother because she finds the Social Security maintenance check, and that opens up almost a, I think, quite complicated political question of, are foster families real families? Are they given special treatment because they're being paid by the state to look after these kids? Why are other families not given money by the state?
That sounds like something that would form the key plot in a Koreeda film.
Hirokazu Koreeda film, yeah. Exactly. That's almost like a social drama. We then also have references to child abuse. Marnie talking about how this housekeeper, childminder figure that she has, will beat her.
Yeah. And it's interesting that all of these moments, they're all set up under this guise of a summer sunny romance. And the first time that you view these incidents, you almost don't fully appreciate what's really happening. It's kind of played off as a joke, the way that Marnie kind of throws a blanket over the old woman who runs the house, and they're all quite banterful and playful. And it's only in this shift in the final third of the film that you're recontextualizing these scenes, yeah. And you realize really what's going on.
And that her life was quite lonely. Her globe-trotting parents would often leave her alone for months on end in that mansion on the lake with no one to play with, and until this girl from the future comes along and they form that relationship across time. And then let's talk about the twist. It's revealed that Marnie is a spiritual projection of Anna's memories of the stories she was told at her infant bedside by her grandmother, who was Marnie.
Yes, I understand. I don't. if I'm honest, I didn't put that all together when mm-hmm. I was watching the film. I got lost, mm-hmm. and I thought, if this is going to wrap up with, oh, I had a summer friendship with a young girl from the past and she was a ghost and yeah. she helped me figure out who I am. Yeah. I thought that's enough. Yes. That actually, in a weird way, makes more sense than when this film tries to apply logic to a situation that I think has room to be quite openly spiritual.
Mm-hmm. But he just, Yonebayashi throws so many extra themes into the pot. Another one we've not mentioned is this is the first Ghibli film to talk about race, to tackle that. We have Marnie, who at least one of her parents are Western. She has blonde hair and blue eyes, and Anna has inherited some of that. Mm. And that gives rise to the sense that all along Anna has felt on the outside of that circle where there's an invisible boundary and you're on the outside of it. She doesn't feel comfortable in her own skin, in her society, in her community. Could that be because she's adopted? Could that be because she's gay? Could that be because she's mixed race in a culture, a country, Japan, which has much more of a much, much smaller immigrant population than we're used to in the West?
Yeah.
And he just throws that in there.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many things that are thrown in. And in a way, I love him for it because the ambition is amazing. Mm-hmm. I really admire it, particularly coming off the back of the previous Ghibli films, which we admire for their focus, their understanding of theme and tightness of story, or in, like, for me anyway, those are my favorite of their films. And this is sprawling
mm-hmm.
emotionally, not in a Princess Mononoke way, where it's in the plot. This goes for so many things, but I don't actually think it lands any of them.
It's so fascinating that a Ghibli film, if you think about the spectrum of Ghibli films, this is the one that's most closely set in the real world, can be harder to get your head around.
Yes. I mean, we have seen films set in infinite bathhouses with gods and monsters, and they make more sense than this.
Mm-hmm. And it can be something that I've watched this maybe four or five times now. It's a reason to go back to think, maybe I missed something. Maybe there'll be new resonance here. But it is, I think, endlessly frustrating in quite a compelling way that he doesn't pick a lane, he doesn't explore any of these themes satisfyingly. I know that there are reviews I've read, maybe fan reviews. Most of the reviews that came out from professional critics said, oh, another gorgeous Ghibli film with flights of fantasy in the real world and all the stuff that you're used to. But there are reviews from fans, especially on Letterboxd, which say, is Anna trans? Or is this queer baiting? Did Ghibli knowingly put this in their film for an international audience that wants same-sex relationships in these sorts of films? Ghibli have done young women finding themselves before, but have Ghibli done young women finding things about themselves, about who they love and who they want to be? And it doesn't do that. We don't often talk about films that are, you know, other animated films from Japan. One we have mentioned before is Your Name, which was a huge smash. And that is what I think the pinnacle of what I call the teen feels anime genre, which is where you have a slice of life, boy and girl, star-crossed lovers. But the problem is, what's keeping them apart is the fact there's a time slip device there. And also, there's a major natural disaster that's in
play. And a body swap.
And a body swap, exactly. So,
but again, that's something that is hugely complicated mm-hmm. and has all of these different tendrils. But really satisfyingly come together.
And it can hinge on a single emotional moment. All of this stuff is happening and then two hands touching or just not touching, just missing out on that physical connection can bring it all together. This film doesn't have that. It's almost like Miyanobe Ashi has been seeing these other films, this new wave of new generation
and
storytelling.
It's looking for a click moment mm-hmm. that never happens.
Yeah. And it's just fascinating to talk about.
Yeah.
This is one of those ones where you don't start anyone off with a film like this on their road through Ghibli. But once they have maybe 5 or 6, or in your case, 12 films under your belt, we can show them this. It's so interesting.
Yeah. And it's one, although there are other films that I've liked a lot more than this, this is the one that I feel most compelled to rewatch as well. It's interesting that you're not a huge fan of this, I gather, but you've watched it 4 or 5 times since it's come out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there are also so many little bits that I love from it. Like, there is some food here that is pure Ghibli. Mm-hmm. There is the chopping of a watermelon and a tomato, and there's a runny egg that is sliced through with some chopsticks that you just want to just leap out to the screen and grab.
You're an avowed fan of chilling out in nature, and there are scenes of Marnie and Anna in a boat just having a nice little row.
Yeah, and doing a Titanic moment.
Who doesn't love a Titanic moment, Jake?
For some people that obviously aren't romantically connected.
Not at all, it's your grandma. Yeah, don't fall in love with that ghost girl you meet on your summer vacation because she could be your gran.
We've all done it, and that's the lesson. So we could go on and on with when Marnie was there. Maybe once we've watched all the other films, we'll do this one and try and get a bit more to the centre of it because there's so much to talk about. I think it is time, though, to figure out when Marnie was there, we'll go on Michael Leader's leaderboard. Here we are. It's that time again. Michael's worst time of the week, where we've got to put all of his favourite films into one lovely list, because that's the only way we can criticise films now. Quickly recapping from the bottom to the top. The Cat Returns, Arrietty, Howl's Moving Castle, Pompoko, Only Yesterday, Ponyo, Spirited Away, Porco Rosso, Kiki's Delivery Service, that was last week's new entry, Princess Mononoke, Grave of the Fireflies, My Neighbor Totoro, and Whisper of the Heart. Michael, where is When Marnie Was There going to go? I'm assuming it's a podium finish for sure.
Oh, Jake, you do like to joke. So if we're thinking about this in tiers, where we have the top tier, which is expanding with every other episode, it seems, where we have, I think, 6 or 7 films up top, which are, I think, close to being perfect, 5-star films. Then we have that middle tier of, I think, high-class Ghibli with a few knocks against them. That's where I'd put Ponyo, Only Yesterday, Pompoko. This might almost be a new class in its own right, where the ambition is there. The spectacle of the animation is just incredible. It is compelling, but frustratingly so. To the point where I've never felt... You never feel with Hayao Miyazaki that he doesn't know what he's doing. And I do have a sneaking suspicion that Hirohisa Yonobayashi and his co-writers on the screenplay didn't realize that what they're doing was creating this story that has 6 or 7 clashing themes of same-sex relationships, etc. And it comes across as messy and amateurish in a way that the other films don't. So in some ways, brilliant. In other ways, really frustrating. I'm going to put this at number 11. Which is just above the Howl's Moving Castles and Arrietty's and Cat Returns of the World, which I think are heavily flawed films that I just don't enjoy as much. But below films like Only Yesterday and Pompoko, which I think have unified, coherent statements. You know that Hisao Takahata has a point to make. I don't think Hirohisa Yonobayashi has a point to make here.
But he has improved since Arrietty's jumped 2 places.
I wouldn't put this in the bad pile at all. We haven't had a, I don't think, a truly bad Ghibli film yet, have we, Jake?
No, we haven't, but that may all change as I've been warned about next week's film.
Yes, so next week's film, we're going from Hiromasa Yonobayashi to another one of the new generation of Ghibli filmmakers. We're going to Goro Miyazaki and his debut film, Tales from Earthsea, adapted from the Ursula K. Le Guin epic franchise.
Yeah, I know that I should be really excited about all the classics that I haven't seen yet, but for some weird reason, this is perhaps the one that I've been most anticipating.
Because it does have the reputation of being the bad or the botched Ghibli film, right? Well, I'll be revisiting, you'll be visiting for the first time. Let's see how it pans out.
Well, until then, we hope you've enjoyed your time in the Ghibliothèque. If you'd like to keep up with Michael on Twitter, you can follow him at Michael J. Leader.
And you can follow Jake at Jake H. Cunningham.
Ghibliothèque is a Little Dot Studios production. Our music is made by Anthony Ng, our artwork is by Sophie Moe, and Lister Russell makes us sound good. The show is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Harold McShill, and Steph Watts. That's me.
Hi everyone, thank you for sticking with us through the credits. This week's nugget is another soundtrack cue. You may remember that Arrietty was the first Ghibli film to have a score by a non-Japanese composer. This film has a closing credits theme by an American singer-songwriter called Priscilla Ahn. It's called Fine on the Outside, but did you know that she actually recorded a whole album of songs inspired by When Marnie Was There? It's called Just Know That I Love You and plays something like an emotional concept album. It's very much in the same emo folk pop vein as that closing theme. Tracks include Deep Inside My Heart, This Old House, Waltzing Memories, and I Am Not Alone to give you a taste for how emo it goes. If you want to dig deeper, it's available on iTunes. Check it out.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.